All right, before we get started today, we do have one case on our 130 docket, but I did want to welcome some guests we have in our courtroom today. We have guests and students from the West Fort Worth campus of Classical Conversations Homeschool Community, and we're so glad to have you here anytime. You know, the courts are open to students, and we enjoy having you all come and visit. And you've got some great lawyers who I'm sure you will pick up some great tips from as well. We do have one case. It's called Perez versus State. If the clerk will please announce counsel who will be presenting arguments.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Weiner will argue for the appellant. Mr. Edward Wilkinson will argue for the state.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Weiner.
May it please the court, I intend to take 15 and 5. The first 15 minutes, I'm going to talk about the first 2 points of error that I raised in my brief. I raised 3 points altogether, primarily talking about the first point, the denial of the defensive charge on self-defense, and then I've asked for 5 minutes for rebuttal. About 2 years ago, two Euless police officers showed up at appellate Andrew Perez's home, showed up at his front door about 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. Because Officer Fimbres, the named complainant in the one indictment that Mr. Perez was convicted on, said that she heard yelling and obscenities from the parking lot of the Euless Police Department. No one called the police to the scene. No one from Mr. Perez's home called the police to the scene. None of the neighbors called the police to the scene. And in fact, Officer Fimbres tried to recruit a neighbor to say that she was disturbed by what happened next door, and the neighbor refused to do it. As a matter of fact, the state interviewed the neighbor just prior to trial, I think the record shows, and decided not to call that neighbor. And in fact, the neighbor did testify on behalf of the defense in that case, Ms. Rogers. So Officer Fimbres decided at some point during this, and then the testimony varies. I don't think any two officers testified alike, and of course the defense testimony was different. But Officer Fimbres did concede that she decided at some point that she was going to arrest this young man for the Class C misdemeanor of disorderly conduct, notwithstanding the fact that none of the neighbors were disturbed by anything. Numerous police showed up. Ultimately, three of the police officers, the defendant, or the appellant, Andrew Perez, was sitting in his garage on a car. Ultimately, three of the police officers counted 1, 2, 3 on some technique they testified they just learned. They testified that Andrew lunged at them. Andrew denied it. If he did lunge at him, it must have been a slow motion lunge because they had time to count 1, 2, 3 before they jerked him off the car, jerked him out in the yard, pulled him out in the yard so hard it pulled his shoes off. His shoes came off. And like a rag doll, as he testified to, and proceeded to, the three of them and additional ones conceded to beat him for a while and to tase him. There was testimony evidence that there were 26 taser burns, including his testicles. This is for a Class C misdemeanor disorderly conduct, where they were not even called out there. This netted Mr. Perez 3 felony indictments for the 3 officers who counted 1, 2, 3 and jerked him out in the yard and beat him. He was acquitted on 2 of the officers. He denied ever touching 2 of the officers, and he was acquitted on those counts. On the 3rd officer, Fimbres, he said that he did, in fact, put his hands on her. He pulled her, embraced her to keep her from being able to beat him so hard. He pulled her to his chest, may have grabbed her hair, as she testified, and so that she couldn't build up the momentum to continue beating him as she was doing. Now, this was the defense from opening statement. I think that alone distinguishes this case from, I think, all the cases that the state cites as contrary to this case. And I've quoted a portion of the opening statement in my brief. Defense counsel says, as she pounded him in the face, the only officer that Andrew touched, in other words, he didn't assault the other two at all, during his beating was and tased was Fimbres. He's strapped down like this. She's on top of him. She's letting him have it. He gets a hand loose, so he's resisting. He's resisting arrest. He gets a hand loose. He grabs her, which tracks the language of the indictment on Fimbres, and he pulls her down, which tracks the language of the indictment on Fimbres, into him to stop the beating. She was killing him. And in fact, he testified that he thought he was going to die. So that's the defense from the get-go. He's just plain innocent on the first two, and with Fimbres, it was self-defense. It's also the way the case was tried, with every witness. And I think there's even a reference in the record that one of the videos that was allowed in, you can hear, none of the videos showed any of this. They were all pointed away, but you could hear the audio portion of the video. You could even evidently hear the appellant saying, I was defending myself. So that's the way it was tried. He got on the stand and testified. I don't even think it was necessary to raise the defense of self-defense, but he did get on the stand and testify. And he testified that he was jerked off the car without any warning. He was having a small talk conversation with one of the officers. All of a sudden, he heard them go 1, 2, 3, as they testified, and he was jerked out and getting the beating of his life and getting tased. He says that at some point, when Fimbres was hitting him on top of him, he did reach up, embrace her, pull her to him, may have grabbed her hair, which she testified to. She testified he grabbed her hair, and that did cause her pain. And he pulled her to him to mitigate the beating he was taking.
And it's your position that is sufficient testimony right there to raise the issue of self-defense and justify the instruction?
Absolutely, and certainly along with all the other testimony and evidence. But, yeah, that in and of itself. But certainly along with all the other testimony and evidence. The state wants to parse wording, and I don't know. I almost expect the state to say, well, wait a minute. He didn't say it happened in Tarrant County, Texas. So he didn't testify to all the elements of the offense. But, yes, absolutely. It even tracks the language of the indictment. I don't even know that that's necessary, but it tracks the language of the indictment. Now, the state wants to take it a little bit further and say, well, it's not enough that the evidence raises self-defense. It's not enough that he testifies to self-defense. And I don't want to get off on this confession and avoidance because it's really irrelevant in this case because he did confess and avoid. But I don't think the confession and avoidance doctrine, which is named for a common law civil pleading, the common law civil pleading really bears almost no resemblance to as it is being applied in criminal cases and certainly bears no resemblance to what the state says it stands for. But even under the confession and avoidance doctrine, he got up and he confessed and he avoided. He confessed to the assault. Certainly, as the York case that I cited, he confessed to absolutely enough that it, on his testimony alone, certainly in conjunction with all the other evidence, the assault conviction would withstand a sufficiency of the evidence attack. In York, the individual said that he voluntarily acted in a way that caused physical pain to the victim in that case. And Justice Lattimore out of this court says, well, that's enough to sustain a legal sufficiency of the evidence attack. And so I think it's ludicrous that the state would contend what is enough testimony to get past a legal sufficiency of the evidence attack is yet not enough to somehow satisfy the doctrine of confession and avoidance. And you think about it, like I said, I didn't want to get off on this, but if the confession and avoidance means what the state says it means that the defendant would have to get on the stand and testify in every case. And that can't be the law. Of course, in this case, the defendant did get on the stand and testify. Testified as per the indictment, pulling and grabbing. I don't even know that that's necessary, but he did. The state wants to take it a little bit further, and they actually argue in their last brief that that's not enough. Even though he testified to what's in the indictment and justified why he behaved that way, Fimbres didn't say the pulling caused her pain. So Fimbres even says that part of the indictment's false, according to the state's argument. So the fact that Andrew said he assaulted her by pulling her to him, even that's not enough for confession and avoidance, because Fimbres didn't testify that that caused her pain, even though it's in the indictment, or that the grabbing caused her pain, even though that's in the indictment.
Is your position that his testimony would also be sufficient to raise the issue of self-defense to a charge of resisting arrest?
Yes. Yes. I think the cases, certainly, traditionally, the cases are real strong on how it only takes a scintilla or something a little more than a scintilla of evidence before a jury is given the option of acquitting someone based on the defense of self-defense. The Kemp case that I've cited. Now, the Naylor case, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around the Naylor case. First off, it was an ineffective assistance of counsel case on a writ. What the Naylor case says, the Naylor case was a defense of accident. I mean, that's what it was. It wasn't like this, where in opening statement they're talking about self-defense. It was a defense of accident case. It was tried around that theory. The defendant on that stand, in that case, got on the stand and testified to accident, basically. And what the Naylor case says, based on that, the attorney was not ineffective for not asking for a self-defense charge because the evidence didn't justify it. They're not hinging that on the way the defendant testified in that case. They said that basically what they said is the defendant did not lay out a case of self-defense. He laid out a case of accident. He doesn't necessarily have to lay out a case of self-defense to be entitled to a self-defense charge, but somebody has to raise self-defense. And in that case, nobody did, including the defendant. So the defendant can't come back later and say his attorney was ineffective for not requesting a self-defense charge in the Naylor case. That's what it says. And it's amazing to me that it has been evidently misread by the state and some other cases to say this is a hardline confession and avoidance case. If you just read Naylor, that's not what it says at all. But once again, in this case, it doesn't matter. In this case, it doesn't matter. Naylor supports our position. So the state says, okay, he confessed to some of the, there were, I think, four disjunctive ways this was committed in the indictment. The state says, okay, he confessed two of those ways, but it so happens that Fimbres says those two ways didn't actually cause her any pain, or she didn't testify it did cause her any pain. Well, that is, I believe, nitpicking beyond belief, and that's not what the law is. The jury could very well have convicted him, and probably did convict him, on the two way, manner and means that he confessed to. I mean, they believed him when he said he didn't touch the officers. They probably believed him on that. Since he wasn't given a self-defense instruction, they had no choice but to convict him on that. Somewhat ironically, that part of the record cited by the state also, in and of itself, justifies a instruction on the lesser included of resisting arrest. I mean, if in fact the state is correct and Fimber said, okay, he did that to me as per the indictment. He did that to me as per the indictment. He grabbed, he pulled, but she never said it caused her pain. There's your resisting arrest charge. There's your evidence that if he's guilty of anything, he's guilty of resisting arrest. Plus, Fimbres on a couple of occasions said that he resisted. And once again, that resisting arrest, just like the self-defense, tracks the language of the indictment. It's not foisting a charge on the state that they never made. It's basically tracks the language of the indictment. Fimbres just never testified it caused her any pain, but it's definitely force. It definitely gave the jury a rational alternative to conviction. Cognitive pleading analysis, I think it's real clear that the elements as alleged in this case, along with the descriptive averments, such as to wit a police officer, are the functional equivalent of the elements of resisting arrest. I see my time's up.
Thank you, Mr. Ware. Mr. Wilkinson.
Excuse me. May it please the court. I'd like to take up initially and basically get out of the way the appellant's second point of error on the lesser included offense of resisting arrest. And I would specifically like to respond to the argument in his reply brief, which suggests that resisting arrest is a lesser included offense under the first prong of the Aguilar-Rousseau, or as old-timers like me refer, the Royster-Rousseau test, which, as the court will recall, the first prong of the test is specifically whether, in order to constitute a lesser, a court must determine, quote, if the proof is necessary to establish the charged offense also includes the lesser, or, as in Article 3709, it states, whether it's established by proof of the same or less than all the facts required to establish the commission of the offense charged. Appellant makes a very clever argument that as to the prong in the greater offense of assault of a public servant, the statute requires, and the state alleged that it was the officer was lawfully discharging their duty. He makes a very clever argument to say, well, affecting arrest, search, or transportation is a subset of the lawful duties that police officers execute. And since it's a subset, it can be deduced from the allegation of the lawful duty, and therefore it is it's the functional equivalent of that particular element of the charge, the greater charge defense. But what he does, it's not required and it's not necessary for the state to prove that in lawfully discharging their duty, the officer was arresting, searching, or transporting a suspect. There are many other ways the state could prove that the officer is lawfully discharging a duty: directing traffic, roadside assistance. This court has actually faced a couple of cases where that was an element as charged in assault of a police officer. Simply answering a citizen's question. It's not necessary for the state to have proved that the officer was actually arresting, searching, or transporting someone. And therefore, it's not under the first prong of the Royster-Rousseau test, it's not a lesser included.
Oh, I thought your argument was she wasn't lawfully discharging.
I beg your pardon?
I thought your argument was in part that she wasn't lawfully discharging her duty. I was trying to figure out what lawful duty she was discharging.
He
said, stay out of my house. You don't have permission to search without a warrant or to come in without a warrant. And I thought that was your point, that since she really had no lawful authority to be inside his house, it couldn't be lawfully discharging her duty.
I'm not sure if I understand your question correctly. Your suggestion, the defense's position is that she wasn't lawfully discharging her duty because she entered into the house unlawfully?
No, that it couldn't be evading arrest or resisting arrest because she wasn't lawfully discharging her duty. She had no authority to be in his house because he didn't give her permission. She had no warrant. She saw no offense.
So, and that may be a defense to the greater charge of assaulting a police officer, but we would maintain that doesn't, that wouldn't automatically entitle them to a lesser included offense
of
resisting.
That's right. I'm sorry, I got it backwards.
Under the first prong of the Aguilar-Rousseau test. We also go on to argue that it wouldn't be logical given all the testimony. The defense couldn't have parsed the testimony out to make any, to logically reach a rational conclusion that the resisting, if he was guilty of any offense, he was guilty only of resisting arrest. My argument right now is addressed merely to the first prong of the Aguilar-Rousseau test. The same argument that it's not necessary to prove goes to his other argument as to why he was entitled to the lesser included under the first prong of the Rousseau test. He suggests that Strzok grabbed or pulled the police as alleged in the indictment. Same sort of thing. It can be deduced. It can actually, you can reason that all those things could be preventing or obstructing the officer from making an arrest. But it's not necessarily so, as Gershwin said. It ain't necessarily so. It's not necessary or required that the state prove striking, grabbing, or pulling the police in order to prove that someone was preventing or obstructing an arrest, search, or transportation. And therefore, again, that element fails under the first prong of the Royster-Rousseau test as well. So the state maintains that it's not even necessary to get the second prong of the test under the lesser included because he fails under at least two elements of the first prong. Turning to the first issue that he has raised as to the submission of the defense of self-defense, the state maintains that Naylor, while it's not a model vehicle for the court to announce that self-defense is subject to the confession avoidance doctrine, citing or relying on the cases cited in the state's response brief, the Court of Criminal Appeals has treated it that way, and the intermediate courts since Naylor have treated Naylor that way. So the state would maintain that while, yes, it's possible probably to parse Naylor and dispute whether Naylor specifically says that or not. Everyone has treated it that way as such since, up to and including especially the Court of Criminal Appeals. It cited Naylor repeatedly for the proposition that confession and avoidance applies to self-defense. Under the doctrine of confession and avoidance, a defendant must either admit or adduce evidence from some other source that he committed the offense charged. Now, the state maintains that it has to be the offense charged, the actual manner and means. Because if he doesn't, then what he's doing is simply contesting the manner and means.
But you don't have to plead manner and means. You don't have to prove manner and means that you actually pled. But he has to confess to the manner and means that you don't plead or that you don't have to prove?
I believe that we do have to prove manner and means. That's why we have to allege it. It's all part of the notice. I recognize it's not part of the statute, but it is constitutionally required as notice so that he can form his defense. And therefore, yes, and we would maintain that he has to for the first part of the confession and avoidance. If he doesn't admit that an offense was committed, then he's not entitled to defense because there's nothing to avoid. There's no issue to avoid. Now, I recognize that the cases are split on that. And in the Court of Criminal Appeals' most recent addressing of that in Juarez, cited in both parties' briefs, the court says, we're going to leave it for another day whether the defendant actually has to confess it or whether he can confess some or all of it or use other evidence to prove up the commission of the offense.
No, but the case law that's developing in the Court of Criminal Appeals is that the state doesn't have to plead manner and means and doesn't have to prove manner and means. There's a case, I can't remember the style, that just came down, and Cochran wrote a concurrence saying that she thought that manner and means was part of the notice requirement, but Keller and Meyer and everybody but Johnson pretty much agreed that the state doesn't have to plead manner and means and doesn't have to prove the manner and means that they plead. So if they, that it's almost surplusage. So if y'all don't have to plead it, if that's the direction the Court of Criminal Appeals is going, then how can there ever be a confession and avoidance?
I don't believe that the Court of Criminal Appeals has actually held that yet. That may be where they're headed, but I don't believe that, that we can absolutely do away with pleading manner and means and then proving them up. And in fact, if you don't prove up the manner and means, I believe the law still is that then you have a dissonance between what you've alleged and what you've proved, and it's a not guilty. What they have come back and said is if there's a jury charge error, then you can look at a valid jury charge with the proper manner and means alleged, and then weigh that for sufficiency analysis. But the case still gets reversed under those circumstances, if I understand it correctly. But I guess in response to your question, I'll take another tact at it, and I'll say the Court of Criminal Appeals has consistently held that in a defendant may not confess to an entirely separate offense and then request a lesser included offense. There are a number of cases that cite that. The state cited two of them in its brief, in its response brief. And so I would analogize to that. A defendant can't, in seeking a self-defense charge, confess to an entirely different offense and then say, I'm entitled to self-defense on that. In other words, to give an easy example, if he's charged with striking a police officer, he can't say, well, no, I didn't strike the officer. All I did was push him back. The officer took a step back, and that was the end of it. He hasn't confessed. He hasn't not only confessed to the charge of striking the officer, but he hasn't even confessed to an offense at all. The officer wasn't harmed, and he used minimal force. That's what the state is suggesting happened here, occurred here. The defendant confesses. I beg your pardon.
Striking, grabbing, or pulling L. Fimbres. How can you say that his testimony does not admit to grabbing and pulling L. Fimbres?
He never actually says it. He says embrace twice. And I think he uses the word embrace very particularly, meaning reaching around. You have to understand what he's testifying to. It's unclear whether he's face down on the ground and reaches up or whether he somehow manages with three officers on top of him to wiggle around and then reach up and grab her.
I tried
reach out and pull her down
into my chest to stop the pounding.
Correct. And he says embrace, but he doesn't say.
Mr. Wilkinson, let me finish my question.
I beg your pardon.
Are you saying that the testimony does not indicate that he grabbed or pulled L. Fimbres with his hand? Is that your position?
No, Your Honor.
All right. What is your
position? Our position is, okay. The officer testified that she was struck, that he pulled her hair and pulled her up to him, and that he placed her in a chokehold. Our position is that he didn't deny at least two of those. He specifically denied striking her. He denied striking everyone. He never addressed the question of the chokehold.
But what we're talking about, his testimony, what he said happened. He says, as I read it, I don't see any way around it, he reaches up, grabs her, and pulls her to his chest so that she can't reach back and keep beating him, which is just tracking the language.
Yes, Your Honor. But as I said, he also never, there is no evidence, the defense is exactly right, that is our position, there is no evidence that she was hurt. And in fact, in closing argument, the defense pointed out that there was
no
evidence
that she
was hurt.
What was he guilty of?
He's not guilty of anything, exactly.
But the jury convicted him.
The jury convicted him because presumably they didn't believe his testimony, but even if they, and if they did, then it would have been a not guilty.
He was hurt, but he was convicted.
I beg your pardon?
You just told me there's no evidence he was hurt, but he was convicted.
I beg your pardon. There was no evidence she was hurt by his action of embracing her. There was abundant evidence that she was hurt from the chokehold, from the punch in the head, and from the pulling of the hair. Both she testified to that, and two officers saw that she was they saw her in a chokehold. So there was evidence that she was hurt. There was no evidence that his embrace caused her any sort of injury. And it goes back to the state's argument that there is that, as you point out, there is no offense to confess to at that point, and there's no necessity for avoidance, that he's really disputed one of the elements of the offense, i.e. injury. the cases, in all the cases in which someone has, a defendant has confessed to some sort of conduct in which he alleged, his testimony is different from what was alleged, and they are pre-Naylor cases, they have all admitted injury. The only case that I could find where the court said because there was no injury, there was no offense, was the Jones case, already cited and discussed in the state's brief.
How would he testify that he hurt her if only she is the one that knows whether she's hurt or not?
It's possible that he could. I grabbed her so hard, I heard her scream, I heard her grunt in pain. He could have gotten some other outside testimony, another witness to testify to that.
Only she knows if she's hurt, I believe.
I beg your pardon?
In most instances, only she's going to know if she's hurt.
He could have asked her on cross-examination. But there are other ways to prove it up besides him testifying to it, but that he could have testified to it. Moreover, in closing argument, they argued that she wasn't injured. So regardless of how he might have done it, they themselves maintained, the defense maintained, that she wasn't injured. They did it repeatedly in closing argument.
Evidence must have come from someplace because the jury convicted. So, I mean, they don't have...
I'm sorry?
The evidence must have come from someplace because the jury convicted.
The evidence came that she was hurt, yes. She herself testified she was hurt. She didn't testify that she was hurt as a result of him embracing her.
Okay. When you pled it in the conjunctive. But
yes.
You can prove it in the disjunctive. He confessed or admitted to one of the ways you pled it.
Yes.
And I think Judge McCoy's saying that he can't know whether she was hurt. He can know whether she said she was hurt. He can know whether she acted like she was hurt or made sounds like she was hurt. But only she could know whether she was hurt. So if he confessed to doing the thing that you pled hurt her,
but
I'm confused.
My time is out. May I address the question?
Yes, please.
What you seem to be suggesting, however, is that the only way that the state or the defense can ever prove that a victim is hurt is by the victim testifying that they're hurt. And I would maintain, the state would maintain, that there are abundant cases where the state has proved injury or hurt without the victim testifying to that fact directly. So if that's the case, then it would equally apply to the defendant, that he can prove up that through other means.
Her medical records?
But
there's no broken bones.
Medical records,
there's no
other eyewitnesses, statements at the time. Reactions. I saw pain across. I saw her react in pain. He even testified how he saw hate in her face as she was allegedly beating him. If he can testify that he saw hate in her face, then he can testify that he saw pain in her face as well. So there are other ways that they could prove it. But be that as it may, in this case, I would suggest that's a hypothetical because the defense maintained in closing argument that there was no evidence of pain and actually relied on it. And
all this to me works against confession and avoidance. I mean, his whole testimony is self-defense. I'm trying to defend myself by reaching up and grabbing this lady who according to his testimony, keeps beating me and beating me and beating on the head, and yet you'll say, oh, sorry, you don't get self-defense because you didn't prove you injured her while you were trying to defend yourself. Does that make sense, common sense, in the real world?
May I address the question?
Yes,
sure,
please.
Certainly.
It makes common sense in the real world in the sense that the defendant's not going to get the best of both worlds. It's not going to be able to argue to a jury that there was no injury, therefore the state hasn't proved its elements, and at the same time say, well, I don't have to prove injury in order to be entitled to the self-defense claim. Maybe in the real world, you know, the world can construe what it wants. The court must construe the law. And under the law, he has to, if, as the state maintains, confession and avoidance applies to self-defense, then he has to confess to an offense.
Okay.
State prays for an affirmance.
Thank you. All right, let's add an additional minute for Mr. Ware since we went over a little bit here. He might not need it all, but just in case.
Probably won't need it. I think there's a very simple answer, and I'm not familiar exactly. I can probably find it pretty quickly about why he argued or his counsel argued that she did not feel pain, and that's because he was erroneously denied a self-defense charge. What else is he going to argue after he's been erroneously denied a self-defense charge? He's been erroneously denied a resisting arrest charge. So after making these statements in opening statement and then being erroneously denied these defensive charges that he was absolutely entitled to, I think it probably would have been malpractice for his attorneys to argue otherwise. So he had no choice, and he was put in that position by the erroneous position taken by the state at trial, which was followed by the trial judge. With the resisting arrest, if you buy the state's argument, its analysis of the cognate pleading analysis, which I don't, but if you buy their argument in resisting arrest, which is a quintessential rational alternative to a felony conviction for assault on a public servant in the right case, such as this one. But if you buy the state's argument, resisting arrest can never, under any circumstances, be a lesser included offense for assault on a public servant. That's just not the case. I mean, all the cases at least acknowledge implicitly that it is a lesser included offense, whether or not they hold for the appellant in the particular case or not.
Let's go back to issue one.
Yes, sir.
If I perceive what the state has argued, which I've discerned now, they're arguing that the officer basically testified that she was struck and injured.
She felt pain.
Mr. Perez has testified that he grabbed and pulled her, but didn't injure her. And so they're separating the injury related to the striking, which he did not admit, from what he did admit to, the grabbing and pulling, which he can't tie an injury to. So how do we tie the injury part to the grabbing and pulling separated from the striking part?
First off, with all due respect, I think that's going down a patently absurd road that the state has set out and that no case is talked about. But here's what really is the case. I don't believe she ever said, no, I was not injured when he pulled. I did not feel any pain when he pulled and grabbed me. And as a matter of fact, she said, when he grabbed my hair, I did feel pain. So once again, kind of like the confession and avoidance, this is kind of an academic discussion because she said she did feel pain when he grabbed her hair. Second of all, I think even where she may have not said she felt pain when he pulled her or embraced her and pulled her down to him in defense, I don't believe she said she didn't feel pain either. And like in the York case, where Justice Lattimore in this court said, well, the reasonable inference from these voluntary acts is enough to sustain a sufficiency attack. So once again, I don't see how the state can seriously make an argument that he, as the defendant in the trial, has to prove more than what the state has to prove in order to sustain a sufficiency attack. You know, if you get to parsing, I mean, the jury could very well have believed that she felt pain when he pulled her to him, as alleged in the indictment. Evidently, the grand jury believed she did, because the grand jury indicted him on that. And the jury could very well have inferred that she did. But I don't think we have to make that analysis.
Why couldn't the grand jury have believed the striking part?
I'm sorry?
Why couldn't the grand jury have just believed that she was injured from the striking as opposed to...
Well, then why did they indict on the other three? Okay. You know, the state mocked my brief a little bit when I said that I believe that I've never seen a stronger case for self-defense, a self-defense charge in this case. But having read the state's brief and having heard their argument, I stand by it even stronger. I've never seen a stronger case for self-defense than this case. And that includes whether or not the confession and avoidance doctrine applies even as the state says it does, which is not what the Court of Criminal Appeals says. Even as the state says it does, I've never seen a stronger case for self-defense in a case like this. And
Mike, before we finish, I've got a question.
Yes,
so
ma'am.
Go ahead, whatever you were going to say. I don't want to interrupt your thought.
I'm ready.
I was trying to say it to Chip. I didn't say it very well, so I apologize. Okay. In order to have aggravated assault of a peace officer.
It's actually just assault here. It's not aggravated assault.
Assault of a peace officer. The peace officer has to be lawfully discharging his, or in this case, her duty.
That's one of the elements, yeah. Of a public servant discharging their duty as a public servant.
But evading or resisting arrest, it can be an unlawful arrest. They don't have to be lawfully discharging their duty.
That's correct. And, of course, that's an element that's not in that lesser offense.
So my question is, nobody reported a disturbance of the peace. There was no indication anyone was being injured. Nobody asked the police to come in. The police never searched the house to see if anybody was being injured. How in the world were they lawfully, what duty were they lawfully exercising by forcing themselves into the guy's garage when he told them to get off his property, trying to get into his car, trying to shine lights and trying to get the doors open, obviously to search the car? What possible lawful duty were they exercising? I mean, they couldn't even get the neighbors to pretend that they were disturbed by the noise, that the neighbors were disturbed by the police. So what lawful duty would seem to me the state would want this fallback if there was, in a case like this, there's a question about the lawfulness of their forcing their way into his garage after trying to get into his car. I mean, to me, it just seems, it has to be a lesser included. I mean, suppose he were running from a shoplifting and the police grabbed him. It could be assault of a peace officer, but it also could be resisting arrest. I mean, police pretty well, the prosecution has pretty much their choice of which they're going to accuse him of something like this.
Am I just totally missing
the boat? I mean, did y'all concede there was some lawful reason for them to force their way into the garage and try to get into his car and refuse to leave his property?
Well, I'm with you, Justice Dofino. I'm certainly not conceding that. I think with all the police testimony that they did, by the time of trial, sort of hobble together a case for the legality of it. Not that I believe it, but I think there's evidence in the record that would support an illegal knock and inquire, and then according to them, the defendant actually, of course, they had already made a decision to arrest him, but according to him, the defendant controverted this vehemently. According to them, he initiated the physical confrontation. That's not consistent with the evidence. That's not consistent with his testimony.
Tapes, when have phone calls, police phone call tapes, not been admitted, usually offered by the state, but when have they never not been admitted?
I found that incredible, Your Honor.
I'm just guess I'm just missing the point here, but.
I don't believe you are, Judge. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ware. Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. We appreciate your arguments today and your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and we will adjourn court. We thank you, students, for being here. I understand Mr. Perry is going to visit with you afterwards.
Did you want to stay and see if they wanted to ask
a question? We'll come back out, too, and just see if you all have any questions of us, okay? But first, we'll adjourn court.
All rise.
Thank you, gentlemen.